Let's take 1 Peter 3:7. I think I asked you to do that. 1 Peter 3:7. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives, and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. What do you think the subject is of that that verse? Yes.
Why husbands should honor their wives?
Okay, why should husbands be considerate, honor their wives? What's the compliment?
There's a few compliments, of course. So your prayers will be answered.
Yeah, so that your prayers won't be hindered. Okay. Basically, why you should live considerately with your wife, and the answer is, the compliment is so that your prayers will not be hindered. Everything else supports the subject. Okay. Sure.
Do I have to put why does the interrogative
there? As opposed to what?
Well, just as opposed to, say, husbands should give honor to their wives. It doesn't.
Well, in the subject,
yeah,
the subject is never a complete statement. That is, when you say husbands should honor their wives, that's a complete statement. So you're really, whether you actually state the why, you're really saying the reason that husbands should live with consideration for their wives. You may not say the word why, but that's never complete. You have to complete it with a compliment so that their prayers will not be hindered.
Could you have said the reasons?
Sure.
Could you?
The reason, in this case.
That would be a subject. The reason why husbands...
Yeah, the reason why husbands, and
the
there you've got the why.
The why still comes into it.
Yeah, or but you could say the reason that husband. It's not that kind of a statement. It's just that it's when you're all through, you ask what's the subject, the reason that husbands should live considerately with their wives. That's not a complete idea.
Right.
The compliment has to complete that.
I could never get away from the interrogatives in any of my work last night.
Yeah, and that's not bad. Whereas you may not always state them, they're always implied.
Are they?
And that's one way of deciding whether you have focused in on the right subject. Is he talking? Well, you know, that's what we'll do. That's what you do. Yes.
And why isn't it how husbands should treat their wives, especially in the context? I mean, there is a result given.
Okay.
But I would have thought it was more how.
What was your subject?
How husbands should treat their wives.
Okay, what's your compliment?
They should treat them thoughtfully and with respect. Now, I know there's a result coming from that, but I'm, particularly in the context, I would have thought that result is not the essential thing.
All right, and I disagree, but what's important here is that if you understand the subject, the concept of subject and complement, then one of the kinds of discussions we can get into is that the correct subject? Is that the correct complement? The fact that we disagree is, at this point for me, irrelevant. If you understand what we're trying to do, when we get together at the seminary, we team teach a course in New Testament and homiletics. And the New Testament department and the folks in homiletics get together and we work our way through a book. And we'll come to a passage and we'll say, what's the subject? Sometimes we'll disagree. Almost always we disagree on the basis of the context. That is, if you just took this verse, this is what it... And I think if you just took this verse, the subject and the compliment we had would probably stand out. You may look at the context and say, well, I know it seems that way, but in the light of the context, I think this is what this is. But you can have a discussion about meaning if you're both looking for the subject. You're really pursuing what the person's talking about. So if you have that grasp, there can be disagreement because there's context to deal with. All right, look at Matthew chapter 7, verse 1. I think I... Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you'll be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. What do you think the subject is?
Why should we not
judge? Yeah, why we should not judge. And what do you think the compliment is? What? Yeah, you too will be judged. And not quite that you too will be judged, though you're right, you know, you're into the you're in the circle. What? Yeah, you will be judged, and the same standard you apply to others will be applied to you. So why it's, even though it says do not judge or you too will be judged, for in the, in just taking those lines, it would be, you would think it was saying don't judge or you'll be judged because you judge, but as he elaborates on it, he is really saying you'll be judged with the same standard you apply to others. I mean, that's the, that's,
Matthew 7:1 was the reference we had to work.
Yes.
Do you expect us to go into a context?
No. Just looking at Matthew 7. Oh, I see. I'm sorry. It really should have been 7:1 and 2. Yeah, okay. If it's 7:1, I'm wrong. That was my mistake.
If it was 7:1 and only 7:1.
Yeah. Yeah, if it's just 7:1, it's why you should not judge, and the compliment is because you will be judged. If you take 2, which elaborates on that, then that modifies it. That was my mistake. Okay. That's the second one I made in my life. It's really the third one, because I realized the first one wasn't a mistake and I had to apologize. Matthew 17, verses 15 to 20. I'm sorry, what did I say? 17. Matthew 7, verses 15 to 20. Watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. By their fruit you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit. A bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, by their fruit, you will recognize them. Okay, and this is a tricky one. What do you think the subject is?
Can you identify kingdom persons?
All right, can you identify kingdom persons? And what's the compliment?
Yes, by their Holy Spirit controlled life.
By their what?
Holy Spirit controlled life.
By their Holy Spirit controlled life. Okay. Is a way in which you are reading into that an interpretation. But let's, somebody else. Yes.
How can we know that he's telling the truth?
How do we know he's telling the truth, and what's the compliment?
By the fruit that they bear.
By the what?
By the fruit that they bear.
By the fruit that they bear, okay.
Why is the fruit of life a test of true faith?
Okay, what's the compliment?
Because only he who does the will of the Father will inherit the kingdom of God.
You're into preaching already. That's not bad, but it's not what, I mean, at this point, at this point, it's not what this is doing, yes.
Why you should judge by results.
Why you should judge by results, okay. What's the compliment?
Because appearances are deceiving.
Because appearances are deceiving?
Yes.
Huh. Okay.
What about how to recognize false prophets?
All right, how to recognize false prophets, yeah. What's the compliment?
By observing their behavior.
Okay.
By their fruits.
All right. Yeah, it would be by observing their fruits. It actually, if you know the context there, he is not talking about behavior. If you look at the context, he has said that those who, you know, look at verse 21, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. So you cannot tell the false prophet by his vocabulary. He speaks the same kind of language that the true prophet has. Nor can you identify that person by the miracles. Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? That's a ministry. That's talking. And in your name drive out demons and perform many miracles. And Jesus says, away from me, I never knew you. So you cannot tell the false prophet by his clothes. He looks like a sheep. You can't tell false prophet by his miracles. He's able to pull them off. You can't tell him by his vocabulary. He says, Lord, Lord. And you cannot tell him by the fact that he is identified with the Christian cause, because he prophesies in Christ's name. In the context, what is the fruit of an apple tree? Okay, it's good. What's the fruit of an orange tree? What's the fruit of a prophet? Is what? Yeah. But the fruit of the prophet is what? Yeah, his message. The fruit of the prophet is his message. These people who stand before God are apparently folks who look good. The Pharisees were that way. But the message, of course, in this context is the message that Jesus given in the Sermon on the Mount. And you can test the prophet by whether his prophecy is true to what God has spoken. You cannot tell a false prophet by his life. There are many false prophets who live impeccably good lives. And the idea that you can tell them by their conduct is just absolutely wrong. I know folks who live very ethical lives. You cannot tell them necessarily by the vocabulary. You can't tell them by their outward appearance. The measure of the prophet is always his prophecy. I think the subject is, how do you tell false prophets? And in this, you can tell them by their fruit. Now, you have to ask yourself, what do you mean by fruit? Now, what I just did then, is an interpretation of what the fruit is. Some of you were giving other interpretations of what you saw the fruit. What?
Fruit.
Yeah, and what we sometimes do, the point that was being made, your name again is? Barry's point was, we sometimes will take the term fruit and we'll bring it over from Galatians. The fruit of fear is love, joy, peace, or the fruit is soul winning. That comes from someplace else. But within, in the context of this, that's not what Jesus is talking about. The fact that you have fruit used here and fruit used here does not mean necessarily that the fruit is used the same way in both passages, where you're dealing with an illustration, and you have to ask, in this context, what's Jesus talking about? Okay, look at Matthew chapter 6, 1 through 18. As long as this one is, it is a bit easier, I think. What do you think the subject is?
What are the rewards of private piety and public display?
Say it again.
What are the rewards of private piety and public display?
All right. What's the reward of private piety and or public display? And what's the compliment?
Well, the compliment is the reward of private piety is God's reward. And the reward of public display is nothing.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you're wrestling with something that's in this paragraph. One way you could look at it is why your acts of righteousness, your religious acts, your acts of righteousness should not be done before people. And the compliment is, you would have no reward from your Father in heaven. Or you can flip it on its back to say why your acts of righteousness should be done in private, and the compliment is because you will have a reward from your Father in heaven. What you have here is the idea stated in verse 1. Be careful not to do your acts of righteousness before men to be seen by them. If you do, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. That's the idea of this passage. And you notice as he goes through in verses, the first paragraph, verse 2 to 5, in verse 2, they have received the reward. And then in the end of that section, then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. You have that repeated as you go through this. So the negative is the way it is set up in the first verse. But it is also that the positive can come out of the negative. That is, why you should not do your righteous acts before people. because you will not have your reward before the Father, is the negative way of saying if you do them before the Father, not before people, then you will be rewarded by the Father. But basically, this whole section is guided by that single idea. And what you have is the application given to charity, to praying, to fasting, which would be the religious acts. And the motive is there. What is interesting as you work with this passage, that you have what we have is the Lord's Prayer in verses 9 through 16. And if you look at it, verses 2 through 4 are a complete unit. If you look at verses 16 through 18, that's a complete unit. The same basic structure. When you fast, you've received your reward. Your Father who sees what's done in secret will reward you. That repetition. You get that in verses 2 through 4. You get it also in verses 5 through 8. And then you have the Lord's Prayer stuck in it. So one of the things you have to ask is, why is the Lord's Prayer? I mean, it breaks the symmetry. I think the answer is, as you look at what follows in the Sermon on the Mount, from verses 19 on, you have a commentary on different phrases in the prayer. And you will see that the whole section ends with the section on verses 7 through 12 about asking and seeking and knocking. So that where he begins, the prayer, as you know, divides into two sections. First, you talk to the Father about the Father, and then you talk to the Father about the family. So when you talk to the Father about the Father, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth, the commentary on that is in verses 19 through 24. That is, don't put your treasure on earth. You ought to be single-minded in terms of the eye. You can't serve two masters. That is, the first thing you're doing in that prayer is orienting yourself to God. Verses 25 through the end of the chapter is a commentary on give us this day our daily bread. Don't worry about bread. The forgive us our debts as we have forgiven our debtors is a commentary on chapter 7, verses 1 through 5. The next verse, on verse 6, do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and then turn and tear you to pieces. You know, all kinds of interpretations of that verse. It has to do with evangelism. You know, don't give the gospel to those who would despise it. You know, kind of tough thing to decide before you start whether a person's going to accept it or not. It was applied to the Lord's Supper. But I think it's a commentary on lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. If you know, what you have is the imagery of you know, when the priests sacrifice, they put some of the sacrifice on the altar. Another hunk of the sacrifice was given to the priest as an honorarium, and the other part was given to the worshiper to take home. But at the end of the day, they had a lot of burnt meat. What do you do with that meat that was on the altar? Well, if a farmer had a sheep and the sheep was hit by lightning or something, you could leave it out in the field, and the dogs, which were scavengers, would come along and eat it. But it didn't quite seem proper to take this meat, offered at the altar, just throw it out in the field for the dogs, for the scavengers. You don't do that. It's too sacred. Don't throw your pearls to pigs. The pearls would respond to the pigs would go after grain. If you threw them for some reason, the pearls, the pigs would disdain the pearls. And if you do that, they may trample them under their feet and then turn and tear you to pieces. So when you look at the last petition, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one, the previous petition is saying, in essence, your sins can be forgiven. One of the things I have a responsibility to do is when a brother sins, I need to go to restore him. If he has a speck of sawdust in his eye, I better be sure that I don't have the same problem. But a sawdust in your eye can be one pain in the eye. He is not saying don't bother with the sawdust, but he is saying when I go, I have to be aware of my own sinfulness. One way you can go to restore people is to go and to reach down and bring the brother back, and you're a superior Christian and so forth. There's a world of difference in doing it that way than going with the sense of your own vulnerability and your own sinfulness. Let him who is spiritual restore such a one in a spirit of meekness. You can have crusades of restoration in which you feed spiritual pride. But up above, one of the things I need to do is when I find a brother who's hurting, who sins, I go to him and I try to restore him. But I do it with an attitude of my own vulnerability. So he's talking there about the need to forgive the sins of others. And on that basis, that's how I can come to God, asking God to do for me what I do to others. But now, when he says, don't give the dogs what is sacred, don't throw your pearls to pigs, if this is a commentary on that final verse, what I think he is saying is, if you, in your discipleship to Jesus Christ, sin, and I mean you turn your back upon this, you'll discover that the dogs will tear you apart. They'll take what is sacred, what is given to God. Jesus has been talking about discipleship. They'll take it and tear it apart. Interesting to me, in our country, when Jim Baker fell morally, Jessica Hahn was the girl that 10 years ago he had this affair with. Now, you would think if there was anybody that would come to Jim Baker's defense, it would be Hugh Hefner in Playboy magazine. You think, you know, this is what he's been advocating. Booze, bunnies, have a blast. I mean, you know, you think he would say, wonderful to see Jim, exercising his freedom. Who was it that published Jessica Hahn's sordid account in two separate issues? It was Playboy magazine, Hugh Hefner, that whole thing. When Jerry Swaggart fell out of voyeurism. Huh? What did I say? Is it? Oh, I'm sorry. Jimmy Swaggart. They all sound the same. If there was anybody in our country that we would have thought would have come to his aid, it would have been Robert Guccione, who publishes Penthouse magazine. But instead, he is the one who got the prostitute that he went to see to give her testimony. That is, the people in the society, when you turn your back on your commitment and do what the people in the society are saying you ought to do, because that's the good life, you do it and they'll tear you apart. Brothers can forgive you and should forgive you. It's important that we restore people who have fallen. But I think the warning here is, when you fall into the clutches of Satan, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. That one of the things that the evil one does is he takes what is sacred and he tramples it into the earth. I think that's what he is doing here. By the way, we never do pray, lead us not into temptation. I mean, we do it because the Lord's Prayer is there, but it's too much fun to be tempted. Usually what we pray is keep us from the consequences of falling into temptation. But man, you get rid of temptation, you get rid of all the fun in life. You know, the temptation stirs the blood, you know, fills the imagination, marvelous, for fantasy. I mean, no, the old saw is, do not pray, lead us not into temptation, God might answer your prayer and spoil your life. What you need to know is that behind the temptation there's the tempter. Behind the lie, there is the liar. Behind the trap, there is the trapper. And when you fall into his clutches as a disciple, you discover that those in the society out there that you would think would welcome you will tear you apart. And so don't give what is sacred to dogs, because the dogs will have a feast. And it is that which we have experienced. The dogs fed on Jim Baker. The dogs fed on Jimmy Swaggart. And I think, at least in Swaggart's case, I think he's a believer. I think Jimmy Swaggart really did come to the place where he realized the treachery of his soul. I don't put him down. But I also know that the dogs and the pigs got to him. And the whole cause of Christ was hurt. Got me into preaching. What I'm simply saying is, when you ask why in the world the Lord's Prayer is put in here, it's there because it governs the rest of the Sermon on the Mount through the section on ask, seek, and knock. That completes it, because he's telling us to pray. So there's a case in which the context has guides us. Yes, sir.
The subject and compliment through, you may end up with a sermon idea that's a bit narrow compared with the rest of Scripture. You could well end up with that sermon by encouraging people not to practice their faith in public, not to be righteous in the society, but in fact do it very secretly, and end up with the group of cupboard Christians that we're trying to preach against.
Yeah, you could make all kinds of bad applications of a good truth.
Well, I'm just wondering, when you actually go to write down your subject and compliment, how much should your mind be influenced by the other things the Scripture says on that very topic about practicing your faith?
I think the first thing you want to look at is the immediate context out of which this comes. And you remember, this Sermon on the Mount starts with the Beatitudes. This is the kind of people we are to be. And by the way, it's a great beginning to "Blessed are the poor in spirit." This is the kingdom of heaven. Talk about a loser of an introduction in our day. That's got to be it. But these people who are beatitude people, remember, he says, "You are the salt of the earth. You're the light of the world." But it's important to notice, Jesus never says you are to be salt. That is, get your act straightened up and be salt. What he is saying is, if you're a beatitude person, you are salt. You don't have to command salt to be salt. Salt is salt. And the implication of all of that is that the light is worthless unless it comes in contact with darkness. Salt is worthless unless it comes in contact with meat that is decaying. So the assumption of the Sermon on the Mount is that discipling, and the disciple becomes a witness for Christ out in the midst of that society. You don't pack the salt into bags and stick it on a shelf. But so to come up with that interpretation, that application out of the Sermon on the Mount would be to go against the context of the Sermon on the Mount. So the best context is to look at the immediate context, the context of the Sermon on the Mount, the context of Matthew, before you look at other contexts and other passages of the Scripture. So it is not wrong to do that. The danger is sometimes we jump to other passages before we deal with the passage that's in front of us. Let's see, what other ones are we? Proverbs 24, 30 to 34. I think I asked you to look that one up. I went past the field of the sluggard. Sluggard is anyone who sleeps in any of my meetings. Past the vineyard of the man who lacks judgment. Thorns had come up everywhere. The ground was covered with weeds. The stone wall was in ruins. I applied my heart to what I observed and learned a lesson from what I saw. Little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. And poverty will come on you like a bandit and scarcity like an armed man. What's the subject? Yeah, that's a single word. You cannot have a single word for a subject. It's got to be. He's not telling you everything about procrastination. Say it again. the dangers of being the wages of being a sluggard. Okay, what's the compliment? All right, the wages would be poverty and scarcity. Okay, the result. What's the result of being a sluggard? What you have here in this proverb, obviously, is a story, a narrative. But all of that narrative, that story, is really answering what is the consequence of being a sluggard. And the compliment is it leads to poverty and scarcity. What are the lessons? Or what is the lesson? Yeah, okay. What is the lesson from being foolish and slothful? What's your compliment?
The lessons are a little sleep, slumbering, folding of the hands, and all the implications of that lead to poverty and want.
Yeah, that's not it's not sharp enough. I mean, that. But you could. It's a single lesson. What is the lesson you learn from the sluggard? But if you're a sluggard, you end up with scarcity and poverty.
I thought the subject to me, it looked like he was learning from the situation.
Well, I'm not quarreling with that. It was a compliment that was kind of vague. You could take what he says in verse 22, what is the lesson you learn from the sluggard? When the compliment is being a sluggard leads to poverty and scarcity. When you ask what poverty and scarcity is, he is giving you an illustration. If you've got a vineyard and you don't tend it, then the vineyard will lose its grapes. The ground is covered with weeds. Everything you had is disintegrated. That's the illustration. Okay, he'll lose his possessions, and there you're combining poverty and scarcity, which is very legitimate. That is, when you say you lose your possessions, what you have is poverty will come upon you like a bandit, scarcity like an armed man. You're really saying the same thing in a different way, a slight advance in the second one, that's a matter of Hebrew poetry. So I would agree that that may even be better, just having a single compliment that combines scarcity and poverty. All right, let me. I don't know if I'm leaving you in the dust, if you're mad, sad, feel you've been had, but let me work with you in on the passage in Matthew chapter 18. I think if we work our way through that, we can.
I find it very difficult because what was the subject? There's little ends, but you've got your subject, it's very hard to grab everything and bring it into us, you know?
Well, one of the things you have to do with a subject is to test it as you work through a passage and ask, does that subject contain all the parts of the passage? Right. If it doesn't, it is often because your subject is not accurate. And what you do is you change your subject, don't change the passage. And it's always a great tendency when you have verse 5 it doesn't fit just to ignore verse 5. Sometimes at the end you may cut it off saying that this belongs to another paragraph. Okay, I'll get those in a minute. Alright, as you preach, those of you who've got the microphone is going to have to run around like crazy if you expect to carry this, but what decisions when you go to preach, what decisions do you have to make? Say it's a Monday before the coming Sunday, just down to nuts and bolts, what do you have to decide?
What passage you're going to preach from?
I mean, it sounds very basic, but I know a great many people who spend a lot of time you know, getting underway to get started to begin to know what to study in order to preach. So you have the question of, you know, what passage. How do you decide that? How do you decide what passage to preach? Depends on who you're preaching to. Okay, you think about your audience. If you have to preach a funeral, you're not going to preach certain kinds of sermons. All right, what else? I mean, how do you decide?
I think asking God what does the people
want the people to hear. All right, there's certainly the attitude of prayer. What does God want the people to hear? If my experience is at all like yours, I don't usually find that a passage flashes into my mind demanding to be preached. I find that...
that's one aspect.
It's an aspect, you're right. And then I didn't mean to negate that, but yes.
Depends, you've got an overall plan that you follow.
Say a little louder?
Yeah, it depends if you've got an overall plan.
Okay.
Any plan or a systematic way of going.
Okay, if one kind of thing that you might do if you have a systematic plan is you might be preaching through a book. And one advantage of preaching through a book, which expositors often do, is that if you're in chapter 17 this week, you're in chapter 18 next week. You may not have a ghost of an idea what chapter 18 is about, but at least, you know, this is what I have to work with. So that that one place to start then is with the passage. You say, all right, I'm working my way through a book, or I have a preaching calendar. This is what I plan to preach. Right, what else might you do?
I think if you're a pastor, the common everyday experiences of your people reflect greatly on the choice. Perhaps, okay. Maybe not of the immediate subject, but certainly within the subject of the pains and the joys of your people.
Yeah, certainly there is a way in which you can start with people's needs and then ask what passage meets those needs. So you can start with the passage, and if you start with the passage, then ultimately what you have to work at is how does this passage apply to people's lives? Or you can start with people's lives and say, what passage or passages do I know that will speak to that? If you take the second route, that is, you're always trying to start with what people's needs are, you either have to have a tremendous grasp of the Bible, or you will discover that sometimes you pick up a passage and you're thinking, oh, this passage is really going to speak to those needs. Then as you study the passage, you discover that passage isn't talking about that subject. Now you got a problem because it's about Thursday or Friday. Are you going to fudge? Are you going to pretend it speaks to that need when you know it doesn't? You're going to try to find another passage, and that might be another dry gulch in trying to solve this need. What do you do? Okay. My experience over the years working with pastors is that if you start on a Monday trying to just think of people's needs, you often discover that the passages that you have, you know, thought in the concordance would speak to them don't speak to the need. Your choice then, it seems to be, is to go with the passage but change the need. That is, you cannot with integrity deliberately say in the name of God what God isn't saying. I mean, I think it's a rape of the Bible to take the Bible and say to people, this is what this is saying, when it isn't saying that, and you know it isn't saying that. That's dangerous stuff. In the Old Testament, they killed prophets who did that. But that is it. You know, there are times, for example, if we get in to a war, if something takes place in the community, there are times in which the poorest sermon preached to that felt need is going to be better than the best sermon preached to some other need. There are just sometimes when something occurs and you know you've got to speak to it. Even though you it may have happened on a late Friday night, my son is a pastor. About 4 weeks ago, on a Friday evening, a woman in his congregation was killed in a car wreck. She was a leader in the church, helped to found it, highly respected. Tori, my son, spent most of Saturday in the hospital. She didn't die immediately. He was there with the family. And Sunday morning, he preached. And he said, you know, Dad, it was bad stuff. I mean, I got home from the hospital. It was 11 at night. What I was going to preach just didn't fit this. And he said, I got up early in the morning, and I had about an hour, hour and a half. But I knew I had to speak to what had occurred. And he said, it wasn't a very good sermon. But it was the right sermon for these people who, all of whom were deeply touched with what had occurred. Sometimes you got to do that. You know, there are times when the need is so great, you got to do it. But one of the advantages of preaching regularly is you can go through a book, and the book gives you the passage. All right, when you look at a passage, let's suppose you've been going through, Matthew, and you come to Matthew 18. You know that's what you got to preach. What factors do you have to weigh in choosing a passage in Matthew when you've come to it? I mean, what are the kinds of things you have to weigh in asking, how much of, Matthew 18 do I preach?
Well, that was the question for me,
Okay. It's possible to preach the whole chapter. The question was, could you preach the whole chapter at once? It's possible.
It is, because the entire chapter is about relationships.
Yeah, that's right. The whole chapter is about relationships, so one of the things you could consider. So in trying to weigh that, if they're going to have 30 minutes to preach or 35, what are the factors? What are the nuts and bolts factors that you have to weigh in deciding what you're going to preach?
I'd just like, the first question of that passage is... seems to me to be critical to the whole thing. Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?
Okay.
And although the things that come out of that are not all answering that question, they all stem from his reply to that question in a way. So that however we go about it, possibly we could take the first section about the how to get into the kingdom of heaven and so forth. And so on, go through bit by bit. But at every stage, we need to get back to the fact that these sayings arise from that question.
Okay, that question is kind of the subject that dominates the chapter. But now you have to decide hardcore stuff. You have to decide how much of this am I going to be able to preach next Sunday. So I'm asking, what are the factors that you've got to weigh when you come to make that kind of a decision?
Consider the audience.
All right. What are you going to consider in the audience? How much of it they need?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. How much?
Say particular needs, which could be emphasized, say, from the first half of the chapter, and you thought that was important.
Okay. So one thing you might say is, I look at the congregation. First half is more important to them than another part. That's not illegitimate. What else?
Possibly have you considered any of these other topics in the previous week?
Okay.
Well, you can.
All right. Sure. You may. You have to choose within the passage what your emphasis is going to be. There are some basic things that you have to decide. Yes.
Just on the unity of the thought.
Okay.
The passage.
All right. One of the things you look at is the literary unit. That's another way of talking about the unity of the thought. And what you have in literature is you have thoughts built upon thoughts. That is important to understand. Thought that we have things like Roman numerals and A's and B's and 1's and 2's and little A's and little B, and we may have a C and we may have a 2. Okay, just to give you, to translate this into to outline kind of form. One is an idea. The Roman numeral 1 is an idea. A is an idea that supports Roman numeral 1. Arabic 1 supports A. Arabic 2 supports A. A and B support 1. All of these are ideas. Okay. When you look at an outline, all of these are ideas. Some of these ideas, like, say, all of 1 might be chapter 18. That's a literary unit. But within that, B can also be a literary unit. It's not a literary unit all by itself. It's in context, but I have to look at a literary unit. In this kind of literature, what is the basic literary unit? It's a paragraph. That's the definition of a paragraph. A paragraph is a basic literary unit. So sometimes as I'm going through the epistles or so forth, one thing I might consider is a paragraph. I may have two paragraphs. Each is a literary unit, but they're joined to each other. When I get to the Old Testament, to narrative literature, what is the basic literary unit in narrative literature? The story. So if you're going to preach on the three bears, I really can't preach this Sunday on Goldilocks finding the cabin. Next Sunday, preaching on the three bears who went off on their hot cereal, because people love to be lukewarm. Or next Sunday, you preach on Goldilocks asleep, which is the state of the church today. I mean, you can't do that. And for those, that's not a sermon. Don't take that down. What you have to, if you're going to preach the three bears, you've got to preach the whole unit. Now, sometimes you face problems with that. For example, the book of Ruth is a literary unit. It happens, I think, to be divided into four chapters where the chapters are divided beautifully. That doesn't happen very often. So you have almost four acts in this play. If I understand the idea of the book of Ruth, it's that while God's providence is always at work, it is seldom evident to the people involved. If you want to take an experiment sometime, look at the book of Ruth. There are 7 prayers in Ruth, and they're almost throwaways. May God do this, may God do that. You hardly notice them as prayers. Come to the last part of the book, and all of those prayers are answered. You have the author almost tongue-in-cheek saying, and by chance she did such and such. And you know, because you know stories, that he doesn't really mean by chance. It looks like by chance, but you know it wasn't by chance. In fact, you have that section in chapter 3 where you have an old woman scheming to get her daughter-in-law married. And she sends him, you know, to sends her to sleep at Boaz's feet. I mean, you know, you don't have to know a whole lot about culture to know that's that's pretty risky stuff. Going to this guy in his motel room in the middle of the night. And I think what the biblical writer is saying, that even the schemes of an old woman that get very close to being morally dangerous, God is able to move in that providentially, so that ultimately out of that comes King David, and out of King David there comes Messiah. But if you look at chapter 1 in the book of Ruth, Ruth leaves Bethlehem because there's a famine, and she goes with her husband, and she gets to the far, goes to Moab, and everything goes wrong. She picks up Ruth on the way back. Come to the end of that chapter, and Naomi's complaint is, I went out rich, I came back empty. She's wrong on both things. She went out poor, and standing next to her is Ruth. But often when we try to judge providence, we judge it out of our own present condition. What Naomi couldn't have known, didn't know, was that she misjudged the situation. She didn't know when she was full, she didn't know when she was empty. And she misjudged the fact that God was at work. Okay, as you work your way through a book like Ruth, you may take that dominant idea and lay it out. And then show in each of the chapters how that is being fulfilled. Because the excitement of Ruth is not for most people that you don't know the story. Oh, in our day, it's brand new stuff. But in the ancient world, people knew the story. The only film that I can remember seeing five times was Chariots of Fire. Saw it first in a theater, and I was deeply moved by it. I thought it was a splendid film. And I came away thinking Eric Liddell was the hero. And I thought that Abramson, is the Jewish chap, was kind of a foil for Eric Liddell. And I, you know, I thought maybe it's kind of a put down of the Jews because come to the end and says that Mr. Abramson had become the head of the Sports Federation of Great Britain. Eric Liddell went as a missionary, and when he died, all England mourned his loss. You think, yeah, what a contrast. Then I read an article saying that Jewish people thought it was a great film because they thought Abramson was a hero. I mean, they were cheering for their guy, and they thought he did well. Stupid people go over to China, but, you know, running the Sports Federation, that's what life's all about. So next time I saw it was in a church, and I, you know, looked at it with that perspective, I thought, yeah, that's right. I'm bringing my values, but if you don't have those values, they both are heroes. Now, by this time, I understood the story. I mean, I knew how it ended. But the next time I saw it was in a hotel room. I was traveling, flipped on the television, and lo and behold, they had Chariots of Fire, so I watched it again. And now I was watching for the way that story was put together. I think the key scene in that story comes after Eric Liddell refused to run on Sunday, which for him was the Sabbath, and at that moment thought that he was going to sacrifice the gold medal. And there's a scene in which a friend says to Liddell, "Do you have any regrets?" And Eric Liddell says, "Regrets? Yes. Doubts? No." That's right. That's the way life is for Christians. A lot of things I kind of regret. Wish I could have taken a shot at it. But had no doubt I shouldn't have. Didn't have any doubts. You have regrets. You lose the job because you stand for Christ. You regret losing the job. If you don't, you're a good-natured dolt. I mean, obviously, we don't want to get fired. We have no doubt that what you did was the right thing. Anyhow, all my point is, I watched that thing five times. Now, as I watched, got to the fifth time, as I watched the film, I watched the way it was put together, watched the way the screenwriters wove the parts of the story. It wasn't that I was wondering how the thing ended. I catch on after the first two times. But when you read a book like Ruth, one of the things you discover, the first time through it, you could tell the whole story. But you could go back and show how the biblical writer deals with the providence of God in the lives of these people. And what seems accidental has purpose. And he does that again and again as you go through it. That's how you might handle a book like that. But the literary unit is the whole story. So one of the things you have to ask is, you know, what's the literary unit? I, in the Old Testament or narrative literature, I've got to take the whole story or else it won't work. And in didactic literature, the literature of Romans and so forth, a paragraph or maybe a couple of paragraphs is the basic literary unit. Another factor that you have to weigh, is that just a literary unit? You have to ask, how much time do I have? even though, you know, some preachers think in eternal terms and therefore their sermons are timeless. When you accept the church, you have a certain unwritten contract that the people give you. Pulpit committee never spells that out to you, but it's there. In our country, at least, if you are at an 11 o'clock service, and there's a lot of our churches think that's when God keeps appointments, the time is over at noon. You can get on any time you want, but it's over at noon. If you wanted to extend your sermons, you'd be better off starting at a quarter of 11 and going to 12, and going from 11 to 12:15. I mean, you can just watch an audience unplug at 12 o'clock. You don't need to look at your watch. Okay. If a congregation gives you 30 minutes, 35 minutes, and you keep taking 45 minutes, you're going to discover that they want you to keep that contract. I have never known anyone who was fired from a church because he preached short. I have known men who lost their pulpits because they preached long. Now, let me, you know, file a rejoinder here. I think if you quit when you're finished, congregation will let you do all sorts of things. I think, for example, if you preach on Sunday and you're finished at 10 to 12 and you quit, you're not going to have the deacons waiting on you and wonder what you did with that last 10 minutes. You quit when you're through, then if there are other Sundays in which you go over, because to get through takes you 5 minutes more, that is, you're going someplace, then, or 10 minutes over, a congregation understands that. But if you're always taking it on the far end, the extra 10 minutes, then the congregation figures you're not playing fair with them. And just as a matter of reporting, after watching this for years, my father, who is not a very sophisticated man, but heard enough sermons in his life to corrupt him, used to say, you know, he had a number of good stopping places and he didn't take any. What he meant was, he just kept wandering on. A good sermon has a stopping place. And from the moment you get in that pulpit, an audience, a congregation knows whether you've got a destination in mind and you're headed there, and you're going to get there in as lean a way as possible. And that will mean that some days you get the train will get into the station a bit early and you'll stop. But you do have this contract. So there are some, you get 20 minutes, just some sermons you can't preach in 20 minutes. I have to change the literary unit, or you have to do something, but you can't, you just couldn't do it. There are too many things that you'd have to cover in order to make that sermon go, and say 20 minutes wouldn't do it. And that means it often forces you back to a different unit. But those are the two pressures on you, and they're there. Now, in Matthew chapter 18, and this passage has all kinds of interesting things to it, of all sorts of literary units. If you were to look at this passage, taking the whole chapter, what do you think is the best known verse in that chapter? What is it?
Verse 14.
About the sheep. And is that the one you mean? In the same way your Father in heaven is not willing that any of these little ones should be lost. You run with a different crowd than I do, but it's your crowd. All right, 19 and 20. I think you're right. I think the best known verse would be verse 20. Where two or three come together in my name, there am I with them. Okay. If you think of the way people normally accept or take that verse, what is the subject? If they were to tell you what that verse is about, what is the subject of that verse?
Coming together.
Okay. It would be the benefit of small group prayer meeting. And the compliment is, when you are there with two or three, your Father is with them. Okay, is that an isolated thought. Does that verse stand by itself? This is usually a verse that people quote middle of the week when it's been raining and the only folks that show up are you and your wife and the sexton and one faithful deacon. You know, what's the worst where you gather together? Christ is, you know. Does that stand by itself?
It depends whether you come together for church discipline every week.
Yeah, that's right. Because it's still, but usually it is taken as a verse that has to do with prayer. It doesn't stand by itself because of the word for. Which takes you back. Again, I tell you that if two of you on earth agree about anything you ask for, it will be done for you by my Father in heaven. When people quote that verse, what do they usually think the subject is? Okay. It's how to get your prayers answered. And what's the compliment? Yeah. If folks agree, it'll be done for you. So that if New Zealand is playing Australia and you happen to have a couple of Christians on the New Zealand team, even more unlikely, a couple of Christians on the Australian team, they get together and they pray, Lord, we want this victory. And the people in New Zealand pray the same thing, you know, you end up with a tie. There are times in which you have to go up against the Bible. There's a kind of nonsense if you say, if you know, if two of us agree about this, or you know, then God's got to do it for us. When two other people agree about the opposite, you put God in a bad situation. But that's usually the way it's taken. Are those two verses a unit in themselves, isolated? No, because of the again. It doesn't make any sense to start with again. So it takes you up. I tell you the truth, whatever you bind on earth will have been bound in heaven. It's a perfect passage. And whatever you loose on earth will have been loosed in heaven. What is the subject of that verse when it is quoted? What? Spiritual warfare, okay? And even more specifically in spiritual warfare, what would the subject be? All right, authority to do what? Yeah, bind and loose who? When it's normally used. Yeah, Satan. I don't know if you've ever had people come to you and say, you know, Dr. Robinson, we just had a prayer meeting, and we have agreed together that Satan will be bound. Wish it were that easy. But the idea that Satan is bound, if we bind him on earth, he'll be bound in heaven. That type of thing. So often as you look at the way people interpret this, verse 20 has to do with the power of small group prayer meetings. Verse 19 has to do with how to get your prayer answered by being unanimous. Verse 18 has to do with how to bind Satan. And if we bind him on earth, he's bound in heaven. So, I mean, get this interesting assortment of ideas. I tell you the truth, verily, verily, takes you back to what has preceded. And there you have a paragraph. Verse 17 makes no sense in itself. If he refuses to listen to them, who is that? Verse 16, verse 15. If your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault just between the two of you. If he listens to you, you have won your brother over. Okay. Would verses 15 through 20 be a literary unit? Okay, they would be. But they are not an isolated unit. In some of your translations, you have the word but. It's the Greek adversative duh. It's the mild adversative. It is not in the New International Version. Let me tell you why. In modern literature, modern English literature at least, the rule is that where two paragraphs exist side by side, it is assumed that they relate to one another unless the author makes it clear that he is changing his subject. Let me say that again. Where two paragraphs exist side by side, it is assumed that they relate to one another unless the author makes it clear that he is changing his subject, doing something else. The little adversative does, and I like the New American Standard Version because it will translate that for you. It is mild, so it's left out because it is assumed that what you have here is related to what precedes, and you don't need that connected. That's why they left it out as a matter of English style in the 20th century. So when you look up above, he finds it, what do you think? If a man owns 100 sheep and one of them wanders away, will he not leave the 99 in the hills and go look for the one that wandered off? He finds it, I tell you, he's happier about that one sheep than about the 99 that did not wander off. In the same way, your Father in heaven is not willing that any of these little ones should be lost. Yeah, all kinds of questions. When you look from verse 15 to verse 14, who are the little ones? In this context, who are the little ones?
The guy who's having an argument.
Say what?
The guy who's having an argument with his brother.
All right, but in the broader context, who are the little ones?
Children.
All right, they're children, but are they children?
New Christians.
They're new Christians, or at least they're Christians, and they're probably new Christians. That is, he sets a child in his midst up in verse 2. This is not a verse that deals with child evangelism, though it's possible for children to have this. He is saying that the little ones are those who are childlike. He called the little child, had him stand among them, and he said, I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever welcomes a little child like this in my name welcomes me. So he is not talking about children per se, but those who have taken the attitude of children. Okay? When he talks about children here, what is the aspect of being a child that he is focusing on? What?
Innocence.
Innocence. Humility. He says, therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child in verse 4. I've heard sermons that take off on children. And, we have to be like children. The little children are vulnerable. Have to be like children because they don't know very much. Have to be like children because you got to change their diapers. I mean, anything that pops into the preacher's mind gets here. You have to ask, what is the aspect? I mean, there's a lot about children that is very ungodlike. and there's an awful lot of Christians that act like children. When you suddenly want to say to them, grow up, there is an aspect of childishness, that is, humility, perhaps the idea of vulnerability, that Jesus is focusing on. Maybe the sense of dependence, yes.
When you say humility, then don't you do exactly the same thing? In other words, aren't you saying that you've got to become like this child who's very humble? And I would have thought it's not talking so much about the child being humble as a quality, but rather the child being insignificant within the group.
Yeah, and I think you're raising a very good question, because once you say humble, you have to ask yourself, all right, what do I mean by humble? Almost always, we confuse humility with modesty. Just as we confuse pride with conceit. The athlete who scores the goal, the interview him after it was over, and they said, wow, it was a marvelous kick, you just move it in there, and he did it. Oh wow, I couldn't have done it without my buddies here. They were all there. You know how to talk. That's modesty. Say, man, he's humble. No, he's modest. If he says, you can see this team can't make it without me, I'm undoubtedly the best player on the team and scored the 3 goals today, say, good night, he's proud. No, he's not proud, he's conceited. He may be proud, but he's conceited. Humility is not modesty, and pride isn't conceit. conceit's like a pimple in the skin. Doesn't look very good. God's concerned about the bloodstream. So when you say, humble yourself as a little child, you have to ask, what does that mean in this concept? What is it that a little child does that Jesus says, that's humility?
What a child does or what a child is.
What a child is, and as they stand, you look and say, there's a characteristic about a child that God says is very important. What is that characteristic? What? I'm sorry, I just couldn't hear it.
They listen to others?
They listen to others? Okay, maybe. You got a different bunch of kids than I have, but... faith in what?
Well, you know, children are like children, and they have faith in you. They know that when they jump off a table to you, they know that you're going to catch them.
Okay, maybe, okay. Oh, yeah, I think it's a sense of vulnerability, of weakness. In the context, the vulnerability, the weakness are the characteristics that I think would, you know, be around the concept of humility, and that they're easily hurt. But I'm interested in, yes.
Isn't it to do with position? It's like where he says, if you want to be great, be a servant.
Yeah.
He's saying, it's not to do with, I mean, all those things might be true. This is what it seems to me. He's talking about the position of a kid in that society was that they were not the great ones, they were the little ones. And so all this stuff about faith and that is, and all the other things might be true, but I would put he's saying, it's taking the position of the least, of the insignificant. Like with this, taking position of the one who washes mm-hmm. the feet. It's that okay. same stuff. It's the position that they're not the one. Like, it's not how I treat. It's not how I treat the great Christian that's important. It's how I treat the one who's of little significance. And okay. I think that's what kid is.
They're good. Here. Yeah, I think did you hear the comment that Jesus isn't talking about a characteristic? The office of the child?
Yeah. Yeah. Really, the fruits of that office are what you're discussing. That's faith.
Yeah, but I think the point is well taken. That is that the child in that society, we value children. We assume that all societies have valued children. Children were valued because they grew up when they were the social security system, but children in many societies were not valued. Children who died, I mean, they would die very young. There is a way in which you don't give yourself emotionally to children. But the sense of the office, to use your term, the child is there. Nobody would say a child was great. And the child is... You know, is in a position of weakness, not a position of strength. Yes.
It says here that I think a child is easily influenced and easily affected.
Yeah, as he moves through.
Yeah, because young Christians are easily affected, and we are not to offend young Christians.
Right. Okay. My point is simply, as you look at the story, then in verses 12 through 15, 14, about the sheep going off. What do you think he's talking about there? The son trusting the father. Well, I'm thinking about if a man owns 100 sheep, one of them wanders away, will he not leave the 99 in the hills, go after the one that wandered off? If he finds that he's happier about that sheep, what do you think he's talking about? Yes. I think in this context, he is talking about a little one who wanders off. In the Luke passage, in Luke 15, he's talking about evangelism. But Jesus is an itinerant preacher. He uses the same illustration different times to illustrate different things. So here, I take it in the context, he is talking about the one that wanders off and how the Father values one who wanders off. And wandering off has to do in the context with sinning, being hurt. Yes.
In this passage, trying to get come down your idea of the big idea.
Yeah.
I didn't struggle, but I saw a number of concepts or thought patterns in that passage and slight changes in emphases. And I was saying, my big idea was, what was the will of the Father? That was my subject. That none perish, and the other part of the compliment was that suppressors are punished. I mean, those who try and subvert a child are punished. It seems to be the will of God that none perish, and those that divert a child are punished. And it's God's total will, His sovereignty, seem to be the subject for me in this passage overall. Am I going too broad? Is my question to you.
Yeah, I think you may be dealing with a sub-idea rather than the main idea. I think the dominant idea in the whole passage is the subject is who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And the compliment is, you would, when you think of greatness, you think of position. The king is the greatest in the realm. But Jesus is saying it is not a position. It's a place. It's an attitude. It's that you are like a child. And that is the opposite of what you think of when you ask the question, what is greatness? So in that sense, the greatest in the kingdom is the least one. I mean, that dominates the thing. But now he's going to talk about that least one. And he's going to say, as you go through it, that if you welcome one of these little children, you welcome Christ. If you offend one of these little children, you're under the judgment of Christ. He talks about sin, and he says, if your hand offends you, it causes you to sin, cut it off. And there I think he is saying, you know, the first part is your sin can lead others to sin. Therefore, you need to deal with sin drastically in your life. It affects you, but it affects others. And if it affects someone else, you can get a millstone, put it around your head, and you sink. So he is talking about the way people lead other Christians, and probably new Christians, but aside. And because they are weak and vulnerable and all of this, God's concerned about them. When you come, and let's start at verse 15, because we're simply saying there's a context there, but let's look at verse 15. If you look at verse 15 and 16 and 17, if your brother sins against you, and go and show him his fault, just between the two of you. If he listens to you, you have won your brother over. But if he'll not listen, take one or two others along so that every matter will be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, treat him as you would a pagan and a tax collector. If you were going to look at that paragraph by itself, what do you think the subject of that paragraph is? Within the context. Yeah, within the context. What do you think the parent... Yes?
Your response to a little one who has heard.
Okay. And not just your response, though that I think is... I think you've hit it, but I think it could be more precise. Yes? Yeah. How to restore... A Christian who has sinned. And if you look at that, it seems to me he has given you in verses 15 through 17 a procedure. What is the first thing you do if a brother sins? And by the way, there is the textual question as to whether against you is there. It is clearly down below in verse 21 where Peter says to Jesus, Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother when he sins against me? But textual evidence is 50-50. So it's, if your brother sins, or your brother sins against you, so I don't have to decide the textual evidence. I'm just saying you have to. That is a problem. Is it only when somebody sins against you that you do it, or if you see your brother sin? My feeling by the context, since the textual evidence is balanced, is probably it's just if your brother sins rather than against you, given what is going on in the context. But what's the first thing you do if your brother sins? Okay. The first thing you do is go to him. Why? Why do you go to him? What's your purpose? A little louder, I can't hear you. What? All right. To get it resolved, would you say? What?
Talk with him.
All right, to talk with him about it. But what's your purpose of talking with him about it? Yeah, to win him. Go to him to win him. Okay, and you go to him alone. If something is bad enough to bother you, then something is bad enough to go to that person. If Barry sins against me, I ought not go to John and say, John, you think I ought to go talk to Barry about what he's done? I ought to go to him alone. Okay? If I go to him, my purpose is to win him. What other purposes might you have for going? To insult him, did you say?
Scold.
Oh, to scold him. Yes, yeah, that's right. I'm going to scold him. I'm going to go to get an apology. Yeah, so there are a lot of reasons to go. But you've got to go to win him. That is, your purpose in going is to restore this brother who's wandered off, to bring him back. Oh, yes. If my interpretation is too big for the screen, it covers the wall.
To go to him to win him, isn't that your interpretation of that? Surely you're showing him his fault?
Yeah, but he says, if your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault, just between the two of you. If he listens to you, you have won your brother over. So you go to him to show him his fault, but the purpose is to win him. As opposed, often, to insult him, to get an apology from him, to tell him off, all this sort of thing. If I go, it is to bring this person back. In what attitude am I to go? What is the spirit that I should go, if you were to look at this context?
Humility.
All right. In humility, that would be part of what you would be if you're a little one. What else in the more immediate context?
Concern.
Look, concern. What kind of concern? How would you illustrate the concern? The wandering sheep. That is, you would go with the same attitude that a shepherd goes after a sheep. When a sheep wanders off, the shepherd goes and finds him. He doesn't kick him in the stomach, choke him, puts him on his shoulders, brings him back home again. So, my purpose is to go to win him. I tell him his fault, but I also go with the attitude of a shepherd restoring a sheep. Same basic, that's what the illustration is. If I go to him and he says, no way, Jose, I don't buy what you're saying, then what do you do? What's the second step?
To suggest that that you want to have somebody there to witness what you say,
okay,
to verify your authenticity of what you say.
So the second step is to take one or I'm doing very well. Two with you. By the way, what's the purpose of taking one or two with you? What in confronting this brother? All right. That's why you would take two or three witnesses, but why do you take them? What's your purpose? All right. To verify, but ultimately your purpose is to do what? Yeah, to listen and respond, and you take them to win them. That is, the ultimate purpose hasn't changed. This isn't a vigilante group that you get together to, you know, I can't do it by myself, I'm going to get a bunch of guys ganging up on you. So you take somebody with you. Where did he get that from? Where did he get the one or two? They're from the Old Testament. Where? Yeah, Deuteronomy 19:15. It's in the footnotes. You don't have to be a great Bible teacher and just read the notes. And in Deuteronomy 19:15. By the way, I don't think it's a particularly good idea to go hopscotching all over the Bible when you're preaching. It'll stay in the passage you're working in. But here, you have a reason to go back to the Old Testament, because Jesus is obviously referring to that. In verses 19, chapter 19, verse 15, one witness is not enough to convict a man accused of any crime or offense that he may have committed. A matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. If a malicious witness takes the stand to accuse a man of a crime, the two men involved in the dispute must stand in the presence of the Lord before the priests and the judges who were in office at that time. The judges must make a thorough investigation. If the witness proves to be a liar, giving false testimony against his brother, then do to him as he intended to do to his brother. You must purge the evil from among you. The rest of the people will hear of this and be afraid, and never again will such an evil thing be done among you. Show no pity. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Okay. It's interesting, by the way, just in passing, to notice that what is being dealt with in the book of Deuteronomy is a court case under civil law. Jesus is taking the principles of that court case and applying it to the restoring of a brother. So one of the interesting things to study sometimes is how the New Testament uses the Old Testament. And here it uses the principle, though you're not dealing with a civil case. It is like a lawsuit, but it is not a case as it would be in Deuteronomy. Alright, what is the characteristic of a witness in this passage if you're going to bring somebody with you?
He's actually had to see the offense as well.
Alright, either he has seen the offense or he is there to hear the testimony, because we're not sure of that. But what is the characteristic of this individual? He has to be neutral. He has to be unbiased. That is, that's the one thing that you have in the Deuteronomy passage. If you were going, just on a practical level, going to carry this out, what kind of person would you choose? How would you decide this unbiased person? Yes, known to tell the truth. I think somebody that would be acceptable to the person who had sinned. I don't want to stack it with my crowd. I'd bring somebody that I think he respects or she respects. Okay. I go and I bring two or three with me. What might I discover if I bring a couple of people with me? I might be wrong. Might discover that I've just got an overly sensitive conscience, and the things upset me that ought not upset me. I may discover I'm wrong. You know, the witness becomes now where a person who, you know, arbitrates. So, by the way, in the Deuteronomy passage, before whom does that judgment take place? Before the Lord, right? And who else? And the priests and the judges. So, and that's important as you look at the rest of this passage. It takes place before the Lord. But it also takes place before the earthly rulers, the religious and the civil rulers. Okay, then if that doesn't work, what's the next option if I go to this brother?
Well,
What's the next step, next stage? If that doesn't work, take it to the church. By the way, do you see a principle emerging as you work with one and two? You go alone, and if that settles it, that settles it. It's done with. If that doesn't work, I take one, two witnesses. Is there a principle you see emerging?
Confidentiality.
Yeah, confidentiality, keep it as limited as possible. Because one of the things that happens is that if you let this thing get out, you can destroy all kinds of people in the congregation. That is, there's the idea of limitedness. But I take it to the church. If I were going to take it to the, if you were going to take it to the church, I was going to take it to the church. Who do you think is involved when he says take it to the church? Yeah, the leadership. Why? Why would you say the leadership? All right, God's representatives. I think if the principle is keep it as limited as possible, then you don't want to call a Sunday morning congregational meeting. You take it to the leaders. I think in the Old Testament, you take it to, it's before the judges and the priests.